In 1833, Frankie Silver was hanged in Morganton, North Carolina, for the gruesome axe murder of her husband, Charlie Silver, in their mountain home in Kona. The story of the murder has lived on for generations through the murder ballad of Frankie Silver. Ballads keep tragic stories of the past alive. But does the song tell the true story? Did Frankie Silver kill her husband in cold blood? This is the mystery of the ballad of Frankie Silver. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. Southern murder ballads tell the stories of dark and sinister crimes. As the old saying goes, whenever something bad happens, somebody writes a song about it. Murder ballads are stories that are set, of course, to song. Stories that tell the shocking and violent true crimes of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Now, murder ballads are rooted in storytelling traditions from centuries ago. Some forms date back to the 16th century. The murder ballads of the South were birthed out of Appalachia, where murder balladry was carried on by those who came to America from Britain, Ireland, and Scotland. Street ballads, as they were known, had been produced and sold on the streets of London just a few hours after a murder trial or an execution. The street ballads would be printed and distributed, just like public newspapers. They became a sort of early tabloid, describing the grisly details of the biggest murder trial of the day and sparing no detail of executions of those convicted of crimes. Appalachia was the center of murder ballads in the early American South, with its fascinating tales of lovers, loners, drifters, gravediggers, and killers, all set in a vast and beautiful backdrop of mountains and farmland. More often than not, a murder ballad will tell you of a victim lured to his or her death and of a killer who goes on the run. Justice is carried out, whether by the law or by the family of the murder victim. The songs are meant to teach you a lesson. Be cautious in love. Be aware of obsession, lest it lead you to darkness and a willingness to take a life. Some may come across as lighthearted tales of people who never existed, but a majority of these songs are based on true stories, real people who are serving a life sentence in song. Real families who experienced heartbreak and pain. For generations, families would defend their loved ones portrayed in song, whether murderer or victim. When you dig in and listen to these murder ballads, you'll notice which family member had the most prominent voice, the voice that defined the narrative of the story and kept it alive with each passing generation. The overwhelming theme in these songs is that a man was wronged by his woman and he had to put her down. Murder her for the shame she had brought on the family, for cheating, or stepping out of the accepted social norms of the day. So much so that some have called these murder her ballads. Ballads like Dahlia's Gone. You may have heard Johnny Cash's version. His video for the song featured the model Kate Moss portraying Dahlia. Dahlia's Gone tells the story of a man who ties his lover Dahlia to a chair and shoots her. Dahlia doesn't die straight away, so he mercifully shoots her again, and with the second shot, she died. The lyrics to the song suggesting Dahlia got what she deserved because she was low down and trifling. She was cold and mean. The real story behind this song is very different. Dahlia Green was an African-American girl born in Georgia in 1886. The 14-year-old was murdered by 15-year-old Mose Houston on Christmas Eve 1900, in Savannah, Georgia, murdered after she allegedly called Mose Houston names he didn't like. Houston went to trial for the murder and got life in prison, serving 12 years for the crime. Dahlia Green is buried in an unmarked grave in Savannah's Laurel Grove Cemetery South. Another classic murder ballad, The Ballad of Omi Wise, tells the story of lovely Omi, who fell in love with John Lewis. They agree to start a new life together, but Lewis changes his mind and decides to kill Omi. When Omi realizes his plan, she begs for her life and reveals she's pregnant. But John Lewis has no mercy and drowns her in a nearby river. This ballad is the retelling of the story of Naomi Wise, an orphan girl from Randolph County, North Carolina. Naomi was taken in by a local family and became involved with Jonathan Lewis. But Lewis was also seeing a woman named Hetty Elliott. In April of 1808, Naomi Wise uncovered the affair and went missing. Soon after, the body of Naomi was found in a nearby river, badly beaten, and Naomi was pregnant. 7 years later, Jonathan Lewis would go to trial for the murder of Naomi, but he was acquitted. Rumors have persisted that on his deathbed, Lewis freed himself from the guilt of what he had done and confessed to murdering Naomi Wise. Overwhelmingly, ballads tell stories of men who killed women. But a little-known ballad out of North Carolina tells a different tale. And as is always the case in ballads, there's the crime, there's the story that's passed from generation to generation by families of those involved, and somewhere in the middle, there's the truth. And that truth can be ever so complicated, especially when it comes to the Ballad of Frankie Silver.
His people have still been laid down. His shattering comes to all his sound. His strikes will tear to my heart to see his soul and body part. His alpha ghost I know I'll see, knowing his place.
That's Bird Moore and his Hot Shots singing the Ballad of Frankie Silver. In case you didn't catch those lyrics, his feeble hands fell gently down. His chattering tongue soon lost its sound. It strikes with terror in my heart to see his soul and body part. I know that frightful ghost I'll see, gnawing his flesh in misery. With flaming eyes to me he'll say, "Why did you take my life away?" Oh, the Ballad of Frankie Silver. Well, to be clear, the Ballad of Frankie Silver is commonly believed to be the story depicted in the Ballad of Frankie and Johnny, which is one of the most popular folk songs in American history. But the Ballad of Frankie and Johnny tells a story from a different part of the country, the Mississippi Delta. Frankie Silver's story is from a different region in the South, Western North Carolina. In the 1830s, the Tow River country of North Carolina was defined by small farms and tiny villages. The Silver family settled in this vast and open wilderness in the community known as Kona. Charlie Silver was the only child of Jacob and Elizabeth Silver. Charlie's mother died just days after giving birth to him. His father Jacob would marry again and have several children with his second wife, Nancy. Charlie Silver was known as a strong and good-looking man, 6 feet tall, with dark hair and black eyes, a fair complexion. He was a hunter and trapper who would leave the area with large hunting groups that would be away from home for weeks at a time, hunting beaver and mink. When Charlie was 17, he met 16-year-old Frances Stewart, or Frankie, as everyone called her. Frankie and her parents, Isaiah and Barbara Stewart, lived on the other side of the ridge that the Silver family had settled 20 years before the Stewarts moved into the area. Frankie was a petite woman. She barely weighed 90 pounds. She had fair skin, bright eyes, and was considered a pretty woman and a charmer. Charlie and Frankie were smitten at first glance. Everyone said they seemed like the perfect couple. They married and settled into a small cabin on the Silver property. And about a year later, in 1830, Frankie gave birth to their first child, Nancy, named after Charlie's stepmother. The Christmas season of 1831 would change everything for the Silver and Stewart families. Now, some say Frankie and her family wanted to make a move west and join other family members in a new part of the country. To do that, she asked Charlie to sell his land so that she could join her family and move. But Charlie refused, which is why some believe Frankie Silver was driven to a very dark place. According to some descendants of Charlie Silver, this is what happened on the night of December 22, 1831. Now, Charlie had been preparing to go on another hunting party. It was cold and with snow coming down and more snow coming, Charlie chopped down a sourwood tree. He cut and piled up wood to keep the fire going for Frankie and baby Nancy while he was gone. That night, Charlie came in from chopping wood and joined his wife and his father-in-law, Isaiah, for dinner. After dinner, he mentioned he was tired and wanted to take a nap. So Frankie laid out a sheepskin rug near the fireplace. Charlie and baby Nancy laid down near the fireplace and fell asleep. Once Charlie was asleep, Frankie's father told her it was now or never. She had to act. Frankie went outside, retrieved the axe Charlie had used to chop the wood earlier in the day. When Frankie walked back into the cabin, she crept to the fireplace, lifted the axe, and just as she was about to swing, she saw that Charlie was smiling in his sleep, and she couldn't do it. Her dad walked up to her and told her that if she didn't get it done, she'd regret it, and she may never have a chance like this again. Frankie lifted the axe over her head and brought it down, giving Charlie one lick to the side of the head. Frankie ran to her bed, covered herself with a blanket, unable to look at what she had done. Her father finished what Frankie started. He took the axe, lifted it, and began chopping, and kept chopping to make sure Charlie Silver was dead. Baby Nancy, still nearby, was said to have crawled through her own father's blood. Frankie and her father used the wood Charlie had chopped that day to keep the fire burning in the fireplace. They dismembered Charlie's body and little by little burned his body. They took Charlie's head and hid it in a hollow stump out near the edge of their property. Frankie's father then took the remains that wouldn't burn and put them in a sack and hid the sack among rocks in the nearby river. The next morning, Charlie's stepmother Nancy was washing clothes when she looked up to see Frankie with baby Nancy coming towards the house. Nancy asked where Charlie was, and Frankie explained that he had gone off to get feed for the cows and he should be home the next day. But Charlie didn't come home the next day. The family was worried and decided to send out a search party, but there was no sign of Charlie. The Silver family continued their search. They were desperate for help and sought out a soothsayer from Tennessee. He came to Kona, and after performing his rituals and searching the area, he told the Silvers that Charlie was somewhere on the property because he could feel his presence. Days later, Jack Collis, a friend of Charlie's, became suspicious of what was going on at Charlie and Frankie's cabin because every time he passed by, Charlie's old dog would come up to him and bark and just keep on barking. He would then run down a trail and run back to Jack. Jack thought it was strange, so he decided to check the cabin during a time when Frankie was out. When inside, he found ashes in the fireplace, and when he looked closer, the ashes appeared greasy, sort of like blubber. Jack also saw what appeared to be blood on the floorboards. He pulled up some of the boards and found a pool of blood, in his words, as big as a hog liver. Charlie's dog was outside and going wild again, barking at Jack Collis. And this time, Jack followed the dog that led him to a stump. Inside the stump was the head of his friend, Charlie Silver. The dog then ran to the rocks where he led Jack to a sack with the bones and remains of Charlie that hadn't burned in the fire. Frankie Silver was arrested for the murder of her husband, Charlie, on January 9th, 1832. The magistrate didn't believe tiny Frankie Silver had killed Charlie, dismembered him, and hidden his remains on her own. He ordered that Frankie's mother, Barbara, and her brother, Blackstone, also be arrested. All three were jailed in Morganton, the county seat, in 1832. By January 13th, Frankie's father, Isaiah, had obtained a writ of habeas corpus, which said his wife, daughter, and son were being illegally detained. Barbara and Blackstone would be freed on January 17th, but Frankie Silver would be held over. And in March of 1832, Frankie was indicted for the murder of her husband, Charlie Silver. Frankie was said to have confessed to the murder, but her attorney's defense was denial. He maintained that the state needed to prove its case, which is what the state did. Frankie was convicted and sentenced to hang for the cold-blooded murder of her husband. Now, legend says that before Frankie was to die, she composed a song that's become known as the Ballad of Frankie Silver, and her father had it printed and sold around town to make money. On July 12, 1833, Frankie was waiting for the rope to be tied around her neck at the gallows. There was a large crowd that had gathered to see this woman hang, and as the story goes, she started to sing her song. "O Lord, what will become of me? I am condemned, you all now see. To heaven or hell my soul must fly, all in a moment when I die." The sheriff asked if Frankie had any final words before she died that day. Frankie held up her head, and it seemed as though she might say something. But her father, who was near the front of the crowd that day, sternly said, "Die with it in you, Frankie. Die with it in you." She lowered her head and didn't say a word. Frankie Silver met her end, hanging from a rope for the murder of Charlie Silver. Now that's the story Charlie Silver's family told of his murder for generations. In recent history, the Silver family has acknowledged what Frankie's family, the Stewarts, have maintained for generations, that Frankie Silver may have been driven to murder in December of 1831 because Frankie Silver was trying to protect herself, and maybe even her daughter. The saddest part of the story of Frankie and Charlie Silver is that the only thing that survived for so long after the murder, the trial, and the hanging of Frankie was a song, the ballad that was said to tell the story and Frankie's confession. To be clear, Frankie Silver did confess. She never denied killing Charlie. Frankie's confession detailed the murder, and in it she explained that she killed Charlie in self-defense. Frankie detailed Charlie's abuse of her, her fear that he would hurt their child, all the details of the case that remained hidden during the trial. We now know that there was evidence at the time that Frankie didn't sneak up on Charlie Silver and murder him in his sleep. There was evidence that Charlie Silver was loading his gun to kill Frankie when she picked up an axe to defend herself. And Charlie Silver seemed to have had a few vices, including hunting for women. He was known to leave home for long stretches of time, saying he had gone on one of his hunting trips, but he was really hunting local ladies and having fun, wild fun, away from home. And Charlie Silver loved his liquor, and when Charlie Silver drank, he got mean, really, really mean, and he became abusive. Now at this time, a husband was legally allowed to moderately correct his wife, what was known as the rule of thumb. A man could strike or chastise his wife with anything no larger than his thumb, which is why spousal abuse was so common and socially accepted. Frankie knew about the other women and was told by Charlie to deal with it. As to Charlie's drinking, there was nothing Frankie could do about it. In the 1830s, in the hills of North Carolina, a woman didn't have many options. In fact, many of the women who knew what Charlie and Frankie were dealing with in their marriage were dealing with the same things in their own marriage. Frankie's family lived nearby, and her father, Isaiah, had even mentioned wanting to kill Charlie Silver when he learned Charlie was hitting Frankie. But soon after, It would be Frankie killing Charlie in an effort to save her life. It was Frankie or Charlie that day, and Frankie was the one who emerged from the cabin on that fateful December night. And if you're wondering if this ever came up at Frankie's trial, the answer is simply no. And the reason's pretty cut and dry. The role of women in 1830s society was less than men. And at this time in North Carolina, a defendant couldn't testify on their own behalf in a criminal trial. That's why Frankie's lawyer pleaded not guilty, maintained the state needed to prove its case. And to be clear, the lawyer did this because Frankie's father insisted his daughter plead innocent because they felt it was the best attempt to save Frankie's life. But in doing so, Frankie's lawyer couldn't introduce evidence of spousal abuse or any extenuating circumstances. If she didn't do it, there was no need to bring up the abuse, and there was no guaranteeing a different outcome if the lawyer had tried to claim self-defense on Frankie's behalf. Take the case of Reuben Southard, who beat his wife to death that same year in the same county and was only made to pay court costs. Men would often murder their wives with no legal consequence, which is why the lawyer felt pleading not guilty was the only way to save Frankie's life. It was a gamble that didn't pay off. Frankie was, of course, convicted and sentenced to hang. But there would be efforts on the part of her neighbors and even the jurors who had voted to convict her to stay her execution and set Frankie Silver free. After Frankie's conviction, word of her confession began to spread. When the community heard that Frankie had killed Charlie in self-defense, they felt Frankie had reason to kill him, and public sentiment turned. People started defending Frankie Silver and demanding justice and freedom for Frankie. 34 women in the community signed a petition and confirmed they had seen bruises all over Frankie, that she had been beaten by Charlie. Some of these women had suffered abuse by their own husbands, which meant signing this petition could have been dangerous for them. But they signed because they felt it was their chance to save Frankie. And in a surprising twist, 7 of the 12 jurors who had convicted Frankie signed a petition saying they knew she was guilty, but because of what they learned after the trial, they didn't believe she should hang for killing her husband in self-defense. The petitions were sent to North Carolina Governor David Swain, and they weren't successful. Swain was believed to have his own reasons for not granting a pardon. As a judge, he had had a reputation for leniency, but when he became governor, he wanted to create a new image. Swain knew the Silver family weren't wealthy, but he also knew they owned a lot of land, and the family had influence. The Silver family wanted Frankie to hang, and the governor obliged. Frankie Silver was given 2 weeks to prepare for her death, which is why Frankie Silver's family made one final desperate move to try to save her. Her father bribed a jailer, convincing him to leave Frankie's cell unlocked, and Frankie walked out of jail and met her family, who were waiting to help her get away. They cut her hair, dressed her in men's clothing, and headed for the Tennessee border, with a posse hot on their trail. Frankie Silver's family will always wonder what would have happened had rain not come, had floodwaters not blocked their path. They had to stop and set up camp in a field. Soon after, the sheriff and the posse rode up to that field. They saw a group of men playing ball. As the sheriff approached the group, he noticed Frankie's uncle was among them. He then noticed one of the young men of the group looked kind of familiar. The sheriff yelled, "Frankie, where you going?" And the young man replied, "My name's not Frankie, my name's Tom." The sheriff didn't believe it, but he played along right up until the moment Frankie's uncle walked up to him and said not to worry about it because her name's Tom, not Frankie. And that was the moment the sheriff arrested Frankie again, and she went back into custody to await her execution. Death by hanging on July 12th. 1833. When Frankie died, her father and brother took her body, covered it, and put it under a load of sacks in a hay wagon for Frankie's final journey back to her mountain home. Her father desperately wanted to get Frankie home for burial, but it was July. The heat and the humidity forced her family to face the reality that Frankie's body was decomposing faster than they could travel. Isaiah Stewart knew he wouldn't be able to get Frankie back home to bury her. Frankie was buried about 8 miles outside of town. In 1952, a marker was placed near Frankie's final resting place on what's now known as DeVault Farm Burial Ground in Burke County, North Carolina. Now, most folks agree, Frankie's fate, it was too harsh, that the murder was a case of self-defense, and Frankie should have never been executed. In the late 1990s, a group of students at a school near Morganton, North Carolina, wrote to the North Carolina governor, Jim Hunt, asking him to pardon Frankie Silver. A respectable effort on their part, but the petition was rejected. As to the ballad and the legend around Frankie Silver, she didn't read or sing a confession from the scaffold. There's no record of Frankie speaking a single word in the moments before she died. And as to claim she wrote the song as a confession before her death, Frankie Silver was illiterate, just as her mother and her mother's mother had been. Frankie's father didn't write and have it printed. There was a young school teacher who took the lyrics from an old Kentucky ballad and changed the words up a bit, had the words printed and handed out at the hanging. In the ballad, Frankie laments her guilt, and these words have gone down in lore as facts. Farewell, good people, you all now see what my bad conducts brought on me, to die of shame and disgrace before the world, the human race. It seems Frankie's family, they were overwhelmed by her death, ashamed of all that had happened in their mountain home, which left the legend in the hands of the Silver family. They kept the ballad confession alive for as long as they could to protect Charlie Silver's name as a faithful husband who was killed by a cold-blooded and jealous wife. The ballad of Frankie Silver was well known in the 1920s and 1930s when it was recorded by Bird Moore at his Hot Shots and by the Tow River Valley Boys. Its popularity may have faded with time, but it's still being sung in those North Carolina mountains. It's a haunting tale that tells of vengeance, rage, regret, and shame. The truth of what happened in Frankie and Charlie's cabin on that cold December night in 1831 in Conan, North Carolina, well, that truth's never going to be fully known. But the song and the myths have never died. They live on in the ballad of Frankie Silver.
It's awful dark in this little day, as we my glory all away. My sun goes down, my days are past, and I must leave this world at last.
Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. Wayne Silver, Charlie's great-great-grandnephew, has become the Silver family historian. He's quick to clarify he doesn't believe the myth that Frankie killed Charlie while he slept, and he's quick to point out what we all can agree on. No one's ever going to know the absolute truth, but the story does draw you in. Fellow Silver ancestor and folk artist Bobby McMillan is featured alongside Wayne Silver in a documentary called The Ballad of Frankie Silver. Now, that documentary takes a deeper look into the folklore and the legal side of the case. You can find a link to watch the documentary along with the complete show notes for this episode at southernmysteries.com. If you've enjoyed listening to Southern Mysteries, make sure you subscribe to the show so you never miss new episodes in your player. And an easy way to help me continue to create Southern Mysteries is by listening in the free Radio Public app. It's available on iOS and Android. When you listen there, I get paid. You support the podcast, and the money goes directly towards the cost of hosting Southern Mysteries. The folks at Radio Public have also made it easy for you to directly support Southern Mysteries from within their app. You can tap the tip button on my podcast page and leave me a one-time tip to support these stories, these Southern mysteries. Thanks for listening.
It'll be all right. We're careful what